Keep up to date on the details of the biggest court cases happening in Australia. The Case Law Podcast is your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Join me, Stephen Stockwell, as I unpack the biggest trials and share the details behind the headlines with the ABC's best court reporters. We explain how the law works and answer your crime and legal questions along the way. Search the Case Law Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When you're a powerful figure, a politician, a celebrity, or just someone incredibly wealthy, you often end up spending more time with your bodyguards than with your friends and family. They're with you wherever you go. They see you in your vulnerable moments. They get an intimate look into nearly every facet of your life. And they're trained to protect you, to take a bullet for you, to die for you if they have to. It's 1984. Beyant Singh has been a personal bodyguard to the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi for 9 years. They faced grave risks together and developed a close bond. When a journalist asks Indira if she feels safe with all the death threats against her, she says she has no reason to fear with bodyguards like him. When Singh is dismissed from her service without her knowledge, she makes sure he is reinstated. Her 14-year-old grandson even considers him a friend. Beyant Singh has always been an excellent bodyguard, and today is the most important day of his life. On this day, Indira is draped in a saffron sari, a distinctive white streak in her jet-black hair. She walks briskly down a garden path from her residence towards a gate that will take her to her office. She's on her way to an interview. Academy Award-winning British actor Peter Ustinov is filming a documentary about her. On this bright autumn morning, she's not wearing the bulletproof vest she's been advised to. She's aware of the danger, but she's not going very far. That morning, she tells her young grandson he must take charge and not cry if something happens to her. But now, she's ready for the day's work. She knows the role well. In fact, Indira Gandhi was literally born into it. Her father was India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. She's India's only female Prime Minister and one of the world's first female heads of state. Heading into this interview, she's as confident and unruffled as always. It's but one item on her agenda for the day, and hardly the most important. Later, she'll meet with a former British Prime Minister, then on to dinner with Princess Anne. As she walks down the path, she's flanked by her entourage. A police constable holds an umbrella to shield her from the sun. The group reaches the wooden gate separating her private residence from her office. Standing at attention are two of her bodyguards. The ever faithful Beyant Singh, her long-term protector, and alongside him, a new guy they've yet to meet. Indira joins hands in a namaste, greeting the pair as usual. Without warning, gunfire. 3 rounds hit the Prime Minister's torso. Those are soon followed by even more shots. Many rounds later, the only recognisable thing about the Prime Minister is the white streak in her hair. It's one of India's most devastating security failures. Hello, my friend. I'm Aslan Pahari, and this is Assassin, the show where we tell the stories of history's most shocking assassinations. Indira Gandhi, no relation to the Mahatma, was a bold and controversial politician known for her decisive action, like going to war to liberate Bangladesh from Pakistan, or instituting martial law for almost 2 years. She was a proud Hindu, but also a secular leader. In the end, she gambled her life on that secularism and lost. But a big question remains. How did an assassin infiltrate the Prime Minister's inner sanctum? The story's origins lie, as many do, with the partition of India. In 1947, when Indian Muslims are given a state in Pakistan, others want their own state too, like the Punjabi Sikhs. But their leadership refuses, choosing instead to remain part of India. It's out of this frustration that a modern secessionist movement is born, Khalistan, an aspirational nation for Sikhs. Over the next decades, as the Sikh population grows, so do their demands. When Indira Gandhi first comes into power in 1966, she agrees to a key one, a Sikh majority state. It's the first and only state of its kind in India. For a while, the secessionists are satisfied, but only for a while. In the 1970s, economic conditions worsen. Sikh farmers are struggling. There are no jobs for university graduates, and young Sikhs are becoming restless. The idea of Sikh autonomy is back, baby! The powerful Sikh political party, the Shiromani Akali Dal, makes fresh demands of the national government. More autonomy, more religious privileges, more economic rights, better water-sharing agreements, the list goes on and on. This sets up a confrontation between Indira's government and the Punjabi Sikhs. Indira's opponent in this fight is the famed Sikh preacher, Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale. Bhindranwale is a fundamentalist, an orthodox Sikh man. He wears his beard long, his turban immaculate, piled high and visibly striking in blue. He walks around with a kirpan, a symbolic sword to represent Sikh's martial pride. He sees himself and wants to be seen as a protector of Sikh purity. But in 1970s India, Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale could also be thought of as a militant separatist. Even though the Sikhs now have the majority in Punjab, he wants more. If not a whole Sikh nation, his ambition is for Sikh autonomy, at the very least. In 1978, he provokes a clash with a minor subsect of Sikhism, the Nirankaris, who he considers heretical, fake Sikhs. Bhindranwale himself stays well clear of the fray, instead sending his followers to disrupt a Nirankari procession. Dozens die in a shootout, many of them his own men. Across the nation, Bhindranwale is now seen as an upholder of Sikh orthodoxy. Around the same time, the main Sikh political party, the Akalis, organize a campaign of mass civil disobedience against the central government. A storm is brewing for Indira Gandhi. Here's what the more moderate Akalis are demanding. Sikh autonomy in every way, except for foreign relations, defense, currency, and communications. There's no way Indira Gandhi will agree to these demands, and a wave of violence washes across the state. Hundreds are killed in militant attacks, state reprisals, and bombings. Punjabi Hindus and Sikhs who don't support autonomy are targeted. Journalists, police, and civilians are killed. Despite their past political differences, in 1982, Bhindranwale and the Akalis joined forces to launch a large-scale civil disobedience movement against Congress and Indira. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. While the more moderate Akalis favour non-compliance with the national government as their weapon of choice, Bhindranwale sees this as a weak man's game. He chooses violence. Indira decides enough is enough. She needs to bring Punjab back under control, but negotiations with the Akalis are going nowhere. And Bhindranwale refuses to negotiate at all. All this tension comes to a head at the Golden Temple, one of the holiest sites in Sikhism. Now, the Golden Temple is a very accurate name. It literally looks like a temple made of gold. And today, around 500,000 people visit the temple every week. But for now, it's 1983, and the Akalis invite Bindranwale into the Golden Temple complex. They've had their differences in the past, but the Akalis need Bindranwale protected. He is their leverage in negotiations with Indira. Alliances shift quickly in the subcontinent. The Akalis and Bindranwale are betting that the Indian government won't desecrate the Golden Temple by sending people in after him. The last time the government tried it, the backlash was so huge that the chief minister was forced to apologise. So Bindranwale and his men fortify the Golden Temple just in case. And from these safe new quarters, he runs a parallel government. Bindranwale dispenses his own brand of law and justice. People go to him to settle disputes. He gets a reputation for handing down judgments more quickly and fairly than the actual courts. If you've ever dealt with South Asian courts, you know that's not a high bar. His legitimacy is such that he's even able to hand down death sentences. At this point, no one, not the Akali Dal, not the police, not even the central government, can stand up against Bindranwale. And the longer this continues, the more popular his cause becomes. Bindranwale's men are now lawless and feel invincible. There are daylight kidnappings, unexplained bodies turn up outside the Golden Temple. Even the police approach Bindranwale to protect them instead of the other way around. But the Akalis aren't out of the game. They have one big card to play in their negotiations for autonomy, and they choose to play it now. More than half of India's grain production comes from Punjab. They threaten to withhold access to it, potentially leading to famine in the rest of the country. For Indira, the security of the union is at stake on multiple fronts. She cannot do nothing, so she acts. It's June 1984. Bindranwale has been operating his quasi-government from inside the Golden Temple complex for almost a year. On June 1st, the National Police Force attacks the compound. They fire directly at the building, claiming it's to test the strength and weaponry of the militants inside. But at least 8 people are killed. The following day, Indira Gandhi goes on national TV, promising to take out the terrorists and asking the Akali Dal to end their threat to disrupt grain supply. She cuts them a deal, a final deal, accepting most of their religious demands, but denying their request for political autonomy. The Akalis and Bindranwale refuse, and their fate is sealed. The next day, the Indian government places Punjab under 36-hour curfew. All public transport and communications are halted, electricity lines are cut, and a media blackout is instituted. Reporters are forced to leave. Sikh pilgrims are still being allowed into the Golden Temple. They have no idea what's coming. Night falls, and the army surrounds the compound. They tell Bindranwale and his militants to surrender peacefully or face a bloodbath. The militants reply with gunfire. A few days later, army operations escalate. Cannons fire on the temple from a nearby fortress. Choppers circle overhead, directing deadly fire. All the while, the army calls for the militants to surrender. They're under pressure to finish this quickly. Around the state, news of the attack spreads. Armed mobs form in nearby areas as angry Sikhs plan to defend the Golden Temple, threatening to kill Hindus along the way. That night, an elite army commando unit prepares to breach the compound. Inside, a group of moderate Akalis are feuding with Bindranwale. The commando unit plans to rescue this group before going in for the kill. They succeed, but this success comes at a cost. 19 of the 40 commandos and 2 Akalis are killed. The commando unit regroups, preparing for a full frontal assault, but it's impossible. Machine gun fire from inside the temple creates an intense, impenetrable wall. To make matters worse, the army are under instruction not to fire a shot at the Golden Temple. They're having to withstand intense gunfire without being able to return fire themselves. This stalemate holds for a day or so, but the firepower inside the temple is enormous. Bindranwale has prepared for a siege. So the gloves come off. The army turns to their artillery and tanks fire on the Golden Temple. Bindranwale's sanctuary, the main shrine, is almost completely destroyed. Its outer facade, pillars and canopy are all brought down. We don't know how Bindranwale meets his end. Some say he was killed by an Indian army grenade. Others by tank fire. Some even pin the blame on his Sikh rivals. However it goes down, he and the others are found dead in the basement of the shrine, their bodies riddled with bullets. The walls of the Golden Temple compound are peppered with bullets too. It takes a few days for the army to root out all the militants. Over 400 militants and civilians and more than 80 soldiers have been killed. Some Sikh groups argue the death toll stretches into the thousands. Punjab erupts. Sikhs are outraged by this brazen attack on their holiest site, a place of refuge that survived many attacks in its long history, from invading Afghan forces to the Mughals. Indira's already tenuous support from Punjab evaporates, but she gains ground with Hindus across the country, many of whom see Bindranwale and his supporters as terrorists shielding themselves behind religion. But Sikhs make up a big part of the Indian army, and for the first time since British rule, there are mutinies amongst the soldiers. Bindranwale is made a martyr, a rallying cry for Khalistan. Indira Gandhi, on the other hand, receives death threats and is forced to beef up her personal security. Given the ferocity of Sikh anger across the country, she's advised to fire her Sikh bodyguards, but she refuses. She trusts them. Indira Gandhi takes a very public stance. In spite of everything that's happened, the state will not tolerate religious discrimination. Hers is a secular party, after all. Sure, she just ordered an attack on their most important temple, but she will not have Sikhs removed from their jobs. But for some Sikhs, this adds insult to injury. Not only did Indira's army desecrate their holiest place and destroy the sacred shrine, but now she wants to show the country that she has no fear of Sikhs at all. Which takes us back to that autumn morning as Indira heads to her interview with Peter Ustinov. She walks down the path, flanked by her entourage. A police constable holds an umbrella to shield her from the sun. The group reaches the wooden gate separating her private residence from her office. Standing at attention are two of her bodyguards, the ever faithful Beant Singh, her long-term protector, and alongside him, a new guy. They've yet to meet. Indira joins hands in a namaste, greeting the pair as usual. But this morning, Beant doesn't reply. Instead, a loyal servant of 10 years raises his pistol. "What are you doing?" Indira asks. Beant Singh fires three shots from point-blank range into her stomach. The new guard, Satwant Singh, empties the clip of his automatic weapon into her body. Beant Singh's son later says his father wasn't in cahoots with any other Sikh groups, nor did he assassinate Indira for any political reason. He did it purely to avenge the attack on the Golden Temple. When Indira Gandhi's body arrives at the hospital, it's clear there's nothing to be done. She's covered in blood. Huge crowds are already amassing outside the hospital as word spreads that the Prime Minister is there. For 4 hours, doctors make attempts to revive her, performing chest compressions and feeding blood transfusions. But they know it's pointless. Indira Gandhi is pronounced dead at 2:30 p.m. Those close to the Prime Minister are horrified, but they also know there is now a big power vacuum, and they have to fill it quickly. The way Indira governed, she left no capable lieutenants behind who could take her place. The only person the party saw as fit for the job was her son, Rajiv Gandhi. He's sworn in later that day. At 41 years old, he's India's youngest prime minister. 7 years later, he too would be a victim of assassination. As news of the assassination spreads, now New Delhi erupts. People shout, "Khoon ka badla khoon," which means blood for blood. It's a phrase that quickly spreads across the country. That evening, rioters in Delhi, armed with flaming torches, roam the streets, attacking any Sikhs they come across. And over the days that follow, anti-Sikh violence ramps up even more. Sikh men are dragged from their homes and set on fire in front of their families. Women are raped, houses are torched. It takes 3 days for the police to get the violence under control. Both the police and the government are accused of dragging their feet. In the end, thousands of Sikhs are killed, tens of thousands are displaced. The head of Akal Takht, Sikhism's highest spiritual body, later calls these massacres a genocide. In the decades after Indira Gandhi's assassination, a tit-for-tat of violence and militancy takes hold in Punjab between radical Sikhs and the national government. To this day, the spectre of secession still haunts India. Assassins is hosted by me, Azlan Pahari. Hannah Jose is the producer. Sound by John Jacobs. Kyla Slaven is the supervising producer. Executive producers are Joel Werner, Eric George, and Jessica Radburn. As well as listening to Assassins, you can watch full episodes of the show on YouTube and Spotify. Those videos are shot and edited by Tejas Bhatt. If there's an assassination you think we should cover on the show, email us, assassins@abc.net.au. I hope to hear from you soon, my friend.